home base of Al-Qaeda. That is a new allegation that the lame duck and outgoing U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has made against Iran. This coming from a former FBI director who said, "We lie, we cheat, we stole while at the FBI." What does he hope to achieve by making these baseless allegations against Iran? In this edition of The Debate, we will look at why this so-called maximum pressure policy of the U.S. has failed miserably under Pompeo and the U.S. President Donald Trump, as exemplified by the failed foreign policies of this outgoing administration. Joining us to discuss this further are our guest Jonathan Fryer, who's an author and broadcaster, who joins us from London, and we also have Brian Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Brian Becker. Let me first start with you. The allegation, Iran has become a new, quote, home base for Al-Qaeda, surpassing Afghanistan or Pakistan. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it's laughable. If it wasn't a serious problem that the Secretary of State of the United States, the former CIA director, is actually making up lies in the last days of the Trump administration. Again, it's part of the caricaturing, demonizing of Iran by the U.S. government. That wing of the U.S. ruling establishment that is following Pompeo, they are trying to find other reasons that could be used against Biden should he dare try to go back to Obama's earlier position of engagement with Iran vis-a-vis the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Again, Iran has been an opponent of Al-Qaeda, while the United States has in fact been supporting the Al-Qaeda brand, certainly in Syria, and to a large extent inside of Libya when the U.S. Bombed, along with Britain and France, under the aegis of NATO, the Libyan government, such that it could finally destroy the Gaddafi government. And, of course, we know the chaos that ensued. And in Syria, in Idlib province, the Al-Qaeda forces, Al-Nusra Front, have had virtual control for some time. They are, even in the words of Hillary Clinton, our allies. So the irony here can't be lost. I mean, Iran is a fierce opponent of Al-Qaeda and has been. Iran offered to work with the United States after the September 11, 2001 attacks, an offer that the United States rejected. Meanwhile, the United States has been willing to use Al-Qaeda as foot soldiers in places where the U.S. has targeted governments for regime change. So, again, the irony of ironies. But this is a fabrication. This is a lie. And it's also designed to create enough hostility and animus against Iran prior to Donald Trump's exit that would make it more complicated for Biden to resume détente or rapprochement or a normalization or a re-entrance into the JCPOA.
Well, let's expand a little bit more about what Pompeo has said, Jonathan Fryer. I'm going to quote him. I would say that Iran is indeed the new Afghanistan as the key geographic hub for Al-Qaeda. But it's actually worse. Unlike in Afghanistan, when Al-Qaeda was hiding in the mountains, Al-Qaeda today is operating under the hard shell of the Iranian regime, as he calls it, protection.
Well, this obviously is complete nonsense to liken the situation to that in Afghanistan, where, remember, Osama bin Laden and his devoted troops were based, is absolute nonsense. And clearly, it is a fabrication. Mike Pompeo produced no firm evidence whatsoever to justify his claim, and in fact refused to take any questions at the event where he made these allegations. And I agree with Brian, absolutely, his last point. These have been made, these allegations, as an attempt to really make it as difficult as possible for Joe Biden and his incoming team to reestablish anywhere near like normal relations with Iran after the 20th of January. I mean, I hope that Iran will treat these allegations with the contempt that they deserve and not see it as a provocative move. After all, this is in a sense, a toothless tiger. Mike Pompeo and his boss, Donald Trump, are very much in the last days of their administration. It is interesting that Mike Pompeo was meant to come to Europe this week, but the European Commission of the European Union and the Germans said quite firmly, we don't want to see you. So he hasn't come. He's stayed behind in Washington and is just making mischief on the sidelines.
Well, I mean, one of the things that the Iranian Foreign Minister Brian Becker has said that should be recalled, first of all, he said is Pompeo is pathetically ending his disastrous career with more war-mongering lies. And then he says no one is fooled, noting that hijackers from the September 11, 2001 attacks came from, as he said, Pompeo's favorite countries rather than Iran. 15 of the 19 assailants were Saudis.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, when you think about the whole sort of narrative that Pompeo is providing, it's such a fantasy. But you know, Pompeo is speaking to a limited crowd and with a very narrow agenda. He's doing a couple of things here. As your other guest said, and as I was also affirming, it's trying to throw more obstacles in the path of the Biden administration to overcome, or using Republican allies in Congress after January 20th, if Biden indeed wants to re-enter into a good faith negotiations with Iran, which again we're uncertain about, but it's designed for that purpose. It's also designed to keep Pompeo sort of in the headlines, but not connected as much to Trump at the moment that the entire establishment finally, after a week where we witnessed a fascist assault on the seat of government, deliberately designed to obstruct the peaceful transfer of power, which has been a sort of a central theme about the durability and strength of the American form of governance, showing that it's exceptional, etc. Trump and his minions disrupted that. They broke that consensus position that's a requirement for ruling class politicians in America, launched a violent assault, and now Trump is being impeached today, probably. All of his the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all eight of them, yesterday issued an extraordinary statement to the American forces, saying if you participate in seditious activity, you'll be criminally culpable. This follows on the 10 Secretaries of Defense, living Secretaries of Defense, who warned members of the armed forces, including the Department of Defense Secretary Miller, not to use the military to upset the U.S. election. When you think about all of that, and Pompeo's over there at the Department of State, he wants to have headlines about something else other than his association with what is now a very, very, very isolated regime here in Washington. So he's making headlines to say, hey, I'm over here fighting terrorism. He's talking to his evangelical religious base. Hey, I'm over here fighting against the Muslim terrorists, as he would put it. So he's also, the second part of his plan here is to create space for himself so he's not as identified with Trump. At the moment, Trump is identified with an attempted takedown of the U.S. government.
So do you believe that is the case, Jonathan Fryer? In some sense, it does make sense that Pompeo is using this as a distraction. With the U.S. At a minimum being so focused on the proceedings that are happening on the House floor right now, moving forward with an impeachment against Trump, is that something that seems plausible to you?
Yes, I think there's a strong basis of truth in that. I think that basically Pompeo wants to divert attention from what is going on in Washington. He also wants to rally Republicans towards his cause if he can, by raising yet again the absurd monster of Iran as they see it, so that there are Republicans who have said that they will support the impeachment of Trump, and some who've said that they would even agree to Mike Pence, the vice president, intervening and actually taking Donald Trump down. So yes, by diverting attention is in this way, Mike Pompeo is basically saying, don't worry about Trump, don't worry about what's going on in Washington. The real story is this confrontation with Iran. But this is a very tired narrative which has dominated all 4 years of the Trump presidency, and particularly since Mike Pompeo took over as Secretary of State. but it's not one that's going to go on forever, I don't believe. I think the time has come for a general rethink of the whole relationship between Washington and the Middle East and within the Middle East, because interesting things are happening there as well with the reintegration of Qatar into the Arab community and really a more realistic attitude towards Iran than has been the case for some time, at least from Washington's point of view.
One of the things that I wanted to get your idea on here, Brian Becker, is the fact that you mentioned how this could throw some kind of hurdle or challenge for the Biden administration in terms of it wanting to return, perhaps, to the Iran nuclear agreement, the JCPOA. We are looking at how al-Qaeda has been supported in Syria, whether it's al-Qaeda offshoot supported by Saudi Arabia and directly maybe by the U.S. in terms of weapons, arms, etc. Do you think that there's some kind of effect that this would have by making this type of statement or revelation, or in Pompeo's eyes, equating al-Qaeda with Syria in order to have the incoming administration look at Iran in a negative light when it comes to Syria?
Yes, I think the Biden foreign policy team, when you sort of see who it is, of course, Anthony Blinken, Jake Sullivan. Anthony Blinken will be Secretary of State. He was a senior foreign policy official during the Obama era, and Jake Sullivan, likewise. Lloyd Austin, who's from the Pentagon, literally a general, again taking over the Department of Defense, which is, you know, according to the American system, it's the military is supposed to be under civilian control. The president is the commander in chief. Typically, the Secretary of Defense is a civilian, but more and more and more, everything as America militarizes, the generals are actually exercising operational control. They have to get a waiver first, but when you look at that team, they're not going to really be that influenced by Mike Pompeo's antics at the end of the Trump era. I mean, everybody knows that Trump is isolated. He's finished politically. Pompeo wants to run for president. He wants to be the Republican candidate in 2024. So he's kind of navigating now to be, he doesn't want to break from the Trump team because Trump is still so popular with the Republicans. So he's not resigning like so many other cabinet officials, Betsy DeVos or Elaine Cho. Other cabinet members have resigned in the last week. Pompeo doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to alienate the Republican base because he wants to run for president. And at the same time, he doesn't want to be tarred with everything associated right now with Trump. So what I think he's really doing more than anything, he's doing a couple of things, but more than anything, he's cutting out space for himself so that when he revives his presidential aspirations in 2024, he's got arm's length from Trump by promoting other issues like hostility with Iran at the moment that Trump is isolated, and at the same time not completely breaking with Trump because Trump still is very, very popular with the Republican base. So I think this in large measure is domestic politicking on the part of Pompeo using Iran as a convenient punching bag.
Well, this coming, again, Pompeo's statements and allegations against Iran, Jonathan Fire, coming from a man who stated while he was at the FBI that we lie, we cheat, and we stole. You know, it's hard to take this man seriously with that being one of the things that he has said about actions at the FBI. Now, this maximum pressure policy by this administration has been very, very severe. But not to say that his predecessor, the U.S. President Barack Obama, did not exert that also. Do you think the Biden administration is going to follow that line, or will the approach be different when it comes to Iran?
I think it's very interesting that not only Anthony Blinken, the prospective Secretary of State under Joe Biden, but others in the team are very experienced people who did indeed work under President Obama. I think they'll want to push aside the Trump years and the Pompeo time at the Secretary of State, push them on one side almost as if they didn't happen, and in a sense go back to the Obama era to a certain degree. That does mean that, of course, there will not be straight away a clear friend of Iran, but I think they will take a much more realistic point of view than has been the case with the Trump administration. And certainly there will be a willingness for proper talks, proper negotiations. And whereas I quite understand why the Islamic Republic didn't wish to enter into negotiations with Donald Trump in any form, I think the situation will be very different when Joe Biden and his team, if the team is indeed confirmed by Congress, that then he will have a much more realistic approach. But I don't think we should fool ourselves that it's going to be all sweetness and light from now on. There's going to be quite a tough time for negotiations. But I think the responsibility and the experience of those people coming in with Joe Biden at the head is an encouraging sign of moves to come.
Brian Becker, the U.S. has been accused in one form or another of being associated with al-Qaeda and with terrorists like the Daesh terrorists, whether covertly or indirectly or through its allies. There's nothing new about that. If you think that that is the case, do you think that this relationship is going to, if you agree that is, or disagree, of course, you can let us know, if this relationship is going to continue, whether it's, again, directly or through its allies, in wherever part of the world?
You mean the a relationship of sorts with al-Qaeda?
Exactly.
Well, you know, the U.S. considers all of the forces on the ground as very temporary allies when it makes alliances with them. Same with the Kurds in Iraq, or the Kurds elsewhere, or minority peoples. You know, the U.S. doesn't really have any commitment to any allies. It uses allies for its own ends. In the case of Syria, it didn't matter to the United States that the rebels, the so-called moderate rebels, were in fact dominated by people who chose the al-Qaeda brand. It didn't matter at all. The U.S. wanted to overthrow the government of Assad, and so they were using the human materiel that was available to do that. Similarly, they've done that in Afghanistan ever since 1979. Used to be friends with Osama bin Laden and all of the fighters against the Soviet Union, because the U.S. at that time was trying to overthrow that government in Afghanistan, which was allied with the Soviet Union. So what the U.S. does with allies like al-Qaeda in Syria or al-Nusra however they want to brand themselves, it doesn't, you know, we just have to recognize this is a feature of American foreign policy. It's cynical, it's manipulative, and it's willing to use any entity for its own immediate short-term interests and then throw them away afterwards. It means they're complicit with the worst kind of criminals like al-Qaeda. And at the same time, they can use a struggle against al-Qaeda or a struggle against ISIS as a pretext for the re-intervention of American military forces elsewhere. It's a very cynical, manipulative game.
And Jonathan Fryer, I can't help but recall the special investigative work that came out of AP Associated Press a couple years back that talked about how the Saudi-UAE coalition was cutting deal with al-Qaeda in Yemen. And the U.S. arms were ending up in al-Qaeda's hands. And there were even deals that were cut that not only had U.S. funds supporting al-Qaeda, but that these groups were fighting alongside al-Qaeda to battle the Ansarullah fighters. The U.S. completely aware of this. So then you have Pompeo saying Iran is aligned with al-Qaeda. So obviously, you can see where I'm getting at with this question.
Yeah, I mean, it is at first sight, it is almost an understandable situation how one can justify the American point of view. But absolutely agree with Brian that America doesn't have real allies or friends. It has interests, and it will act according to how it seize those interests and line up for or against different entities according to which those interests are. But what will be really fascinating to see over the coming months is to what extent that the Biden administration will continue Trump's announced determination to withdraw as much as possible from the Middle East and run down the American presence, not only in Iraq, but in other countries as well. And I think that will be very interesting to follow indeed. But I don't think we should be ever surprised by who the Americans get into bed with if, quite frankly, at that time they see it as being in their interests and not necessarily in the interests of the countries concerned.
Thank you for that. Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster from London. And Brian Becker, thank you, from the Answer Coalition from Washington, D.C. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mika Batawa, entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, some negatives of materialism. Materialism has been predominantly associated with negative connotations and consequences. Individuals who pursue material wealth have personal striving for power, desires to impress, control, and manipulate others. They thus tend to forego investment in intrinsic values like family, friends, contribution to the community, and self-actualization. These are believed to be the drivers of life satisfaction or well-being. Due to unreasonably high goals and expectations materialists set for themselves, they tend to evaluate their standard of living unfairly or poorly. This leads to reduced material well-being. An individual's happiness or satisfaction with his or her standard of living, that's called the well-being, the material well-being. And what materialism is doing is, it's increasing that hatred towards our own lifestyles. It is instilling us with dissatisfaction, right? And it, in turn, negatively affect emotional well-being and life satisfaction of a person. So now, how many people do you know around you who are seeking divorce? Why do you think they are getting divorced? Well, one of the major factors is this materialistic lifestyle and materialistic way of thinking. This is where it all begins. Sometimes they don't even realize. If you dig deeper and analyze the situation, how did they get to a point where after being married for X amount of days, months, or years, now they're deciding to apart? Why? It is materialism in most of the cases. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the negatives of materialism. Of course, it's an exhaustive list and we're not going to be able to give it all to you here, but we just wanted to highlight the negative aspects of materialism. And today we brought up for you how it brings about a dissatisfaction in one's life. Increased materialism means increased dissatisfaction. Okay, you want to be satisfied in your life. You want to be satisfied with what you have, your surroundings. Materialism is your enemy. And we talked about divorce. Why do you think these divorce rates are going up? You dig deeper, you see that in most of the cases, if not all, it starts with the material expectations of one's life. So once you start thinking on materialistic lines, this is where it leads you. Studies in various countries in the US, Europe, and Asia have confirmed the negative relationship between materialism, life satisfaction, and well-being. Materialism's association with self-centeredness, envy, greed, miserliness can lead to some negative outcomes like unhappiness. Hey, we all want to be happy. Why are we unhappy? What is making us unhappy? You dig deeper. You do some introspection and you realize these are the negative material expectations that I have for my life that's making me unhappy. Those who have strongly internalized materialistic values also reported higher levels of unhappiness and lower self-actualization. Young people's heightened focus on materialism in the US, for instance, led them to have negative attitudes towards school and performed poorly in school. Islam, on the other hand, provides the model of contentment, which brings about satisfaction and happiness in one's life. So instead of that materialistic lifestyle and thought process, Islam has provided us with the model of satisfaction. It's also called qana'ah, right? You have to be satisfied with what you have and thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for it. What does it bring you? It brings you happiness and satisfaction in your life, in your family life, right? So this is the lesson of today. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Reporters. As things stand, it is very unclear how many people in the EU have so far actually received a COVID-19 vaccine, how many doses are currently being sent to each of the 27 member states, and when various groups can expect to get the jab. EU lawmakers have been discussing the issue in the European Parliament.
European Union citizens have a lot less vaccines available to them than they should have. The European Commission has planned this badly. Perhaps they were too bureaucratic.
On the 15th of October last, the European Commission set out clear guidelines to encourage each government in the EU to prepare for vaccination rollout, including the need to have sufficient numbers of trained personnel.
We invite the members to reflect on making sure that the necessary infrastructure is in place, that the necessary equipment is in place, taking into account the technical specificities of the vaccines.
Despite being given 2.5 months' notice, many EU countries did not prepare. Vaccines were left in boxes instead of being put into people's arms. We have been speaking to citizens about the vaccine rollout.
Things are not that well done at the moment. I think that we lack some information about everything. People need to know.
It was too slow, but now we have vaccines, then we must quickly act.
Yeah, I think it's better to have done it safely, but I mean, the price to pay is that it may take a bit longer.
More people have now been vaccinated in the UK than in all of the 27 EU member states combined.
Could we have been doing more about creating better capacity building for the manufacturing of the vaccines? And could we have done more in order to adjust the expectations from the citizens about the speediness of how we roll out these vaccines?
Some lawmakers say the credibility of the EU is being undermined by the fact that some member states, such as Germany, Denmark and Cyprus, are seeking extra vaccines outside of the European Commission's vaccine strategy. With the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna vaccines having already been approved for use in the EU, the European Medicines Agency is due to give the green light to a third, the AstraZeneca vaccine, on the 29th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's oil ministry has signed major investment agreements with domestic contractors in a bid to boost crude oil production. As part of the deals, the National Iranian South Oil Company and the Iranian Offshore Oil Company agreed to contract out major onshore projects in four oil-rich provinces, as well as offshore projects in the Persian Gulf, to domestic companies. The projects are worth $1.2 billion. Oil Minister Bijan Namdar Zangane says this is the last stage of a plan that aims to boost Iran's crude output by some 300,000 barrels a day.
We have pursued this plan since a few years ago, and today the 31st contract was signed. The agreements will ramp up the output by increasing the recovery factor of our oil fields. This is estimated to add about $1.5 billion annually to our total oil income.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. The country's oil production has almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day since U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal and reimposed unilateral oil embargoes on Iran 3 years ago. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels a day, down from 2.5 million. Zangane says Iran plans to increase its oil production by more than twofold next year, to 4.5 million barrels per day.
Due to the sanctions, the share of oil exports in our annual budget has slashed by 14%. But the restrictions have pushed us to discover new domestic capacities to keep the oil industry afloat. All of these contracts have been signed with Iranian contractors. Furthermore, over 70% of the needed equipment are manufactured indigenously. We are not going to relinquish our domestic capacities in the oil industry, even if the sanctions are lifted.
Last year, oil exports accounted for 35% of Iran's budget. Along with the U.S. sanctions, the coronavirus pandemic has also squeezed Iran's oil revenues by cutting global demand.
While Iran is poised to make a strong comeback to the oil market, officials say crude revenues will cover only 25% of the country's next year budget, despite a projected rise in exports. This is Tehran is making a strategic shift to non-oil revenues to shield the economy from the ups and downs of its petroleum sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
...2021 will not be any better than the previous years for the health sector in Yemen. This was confirmed by Health Minister Taha al-Mutawakkil in a press conference in the capital Sana'a in response to questions regarding the future of the health situation in Yemen amid the war.
The suffering we are facing today is immense. The needs of the Yemeni people are huge and the infrastructure is poor. Then comes the aggression and the unjust blockade on Yemen, which contributed to the partial or total destruction of medical facilities. More than 315 medical facilities were destroyed by the aggression, including medical centers where international organizations were working. Medicines and medical equipment were also banned from entering the country.
The health minister expects 90% of medical equipment to be out of service in the upcoming weeks due to the end of their lifespan, the continuation of the blockade, and the oil derivatives crisis that has affected the power generation.
The international support provided to the Yemeni's health sector can only account for a maximum of 20% of the shortages in light of the spreading disease and the growing number of malnourished patients. All these are the result of the war and the siege imposed on Yemenis.
The health sector in Yemen has faced a tragic situation since the start of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in March 2015, during which tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, were killed and millions of families were displaced. Continued silence is still the position of the United Nations and international community towards the suffering of the people of Yemen, while the Saudi-led blockade has deprived them of most of their basic needs in life. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنعاء.
Leaders of Russia, Armenia and Azerbaijan set for talks in the Russian capital Moscow to discuss the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh. The negotiations lasted about 4 hours, during which Russian President Vladimir Putin called for resolving issues connected with the peacekeeping operation, as well as clarification of demarcation lines, humanitarian problems and protection of cultural heritage sites.
Today we can note with satisfaction that trilateral agreements are applied in practice. We believe that it creates necessary conditions for a full-fledged settlement of the old conflict on the just basis in the interests of both Azeri and Armenian nations.
Putin thanked Aliyev and Pashinyan for the fact that they positively perceived the active mediation actions of Russia aimed at stopping the bloodshed and stabilizing the situation. After 6 weeks of deadly fighting in and around Karabakh in September, Yerevan and Baku eventually agreed on November 9th to end hostilities under a Moscow broker deal that secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan in Karabakh and seven surrounding districts. The situation seems calm, with the exchange of prisoners and bodies of the dead carried out smoothly.
I believe that the key to success is to put an end to the presence of non-regional players such as France and the U.S. Experience shows that integration of regional players lead to great achievements. As we saw in the case of Syria, regional conflicts are resolved only when regional players sit for talks.
Following the trilateral talks in the Kremlin, the parties signed a joint statement on the development of Nagorno-Karabakh. To this end, it was decided that a plan be presented in the near future by the deputy prime ministers of Russia, Azerbaijan and Armenia.
2 months have passed since the ceasefire was signed. Our presence here shows that we are determined to fulfill the commitments made in September and November.
Unfortunately, today we couldn't resolve the issue of war prisoners. This is the most sensitive and painful issue. We agreed to continue our cooperation in this area. We believe that the 8th paragraph of our joint statement has not yet been fully implemented. I hope we could make a concrete decision as soon as possible.
As part of the ceasefire, nearly 2,000 Russian peacekeepers have stationed along the Lachin Corridor in Azerbaijan, a 60 kilometers long route that links Khankendi to Armenia.
According to the Russian Ministry of Defense, by January 10th, over 48,000 refugees from Armenia returned to the region. The Russian department conducts round-the-clock monitoring of the situation and the ceasefire in the region. In addition, deepening work continues. Марина Картунова, Москва.
In less than 2 weeks, Democrat Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. But unlike the country's much-touted slogan of peaceful transition of power, nothing within the country seems peaceful. The capital, Washington, D.C., saw unprecedented fatal riots on the Capitol building. It all began after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump attacked Congress during its meeting to certify Biden's win in the November election. Officials have blamed Trump for inciting the violence as he kept refusing for months to concede defeat. They say U.S. democracy is in danger. President Trump now faces threats of impeachment just days before his tenure comes to an end. House Democrats have already drafted articles of impeachment against Trump over the Wednesday insurrection. The draft was prepared after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Trump to resign immediately. She also urged the invocation of the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment calls for the removal of a president who is unable to discharge his official duties. Trump has been shunned by many members of his own Republican Party as well. President-elect Biden has also called him one of the most incompetent presidents in U.S. history. Outside the country, world leaders, including Washington's allies, have criticized Trump supporters' attack on Capitol Hill.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters incited by the current president and other politicians. Violence has no place in our societies, and extremists will not succeed in overruling the will of the people.
Britain has reacted too.
What President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
France criticized the Capitol riot, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel blamed Trump for sharing the blame. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro called the violence a reflection of what Washington has been using to do with other countries.
What we see that Donald Trump did, without a doubt, is what they're used to doing with the countries of the world. These same poor rural whites are the ones one sees dressed up as Superman invading Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Panama, and Grenada.
The U.S. has always regarded itself as the bastion of democracy in the world. Now, the recent chaotic scenes are seen as undeniable proof of the fragility of democracy there, while they also mark an extraordinary moment in the American history.
The serial killings of Iranian scientists must stop. This comment was made by families of the five slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now the households of the victims have filed the lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
Yesterday, we presented the case to Iran's Shahid Beheshti Court for International Affairs. Of course, the case will demand that those culpable in the killing of the nuclear scientists face justice. Such a case is not unprecedented, since the U.S. has for several times taken a similar path against our government and froze our government's foreign assets.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but it is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we filed a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's criminal agenda. If finalized, the case will lead to the seizure of $100 million of U.S. assets in foreign banks.
The legal action comes over a month after the assassination of top Iranian nuclear figure Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which, as in the previous incidents, Iran blames on Israel. Israel has a history of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the fifth victim. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the killings, its footsteps can be tracked. In video recorded in 2018, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad Putin. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Coupled with the EU's lack of commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal, the assassination of Fakhrizadeh made Iran change its policy with regards to its nuclear program. In response, the Islamic Republic officially announced that it resumed enriching uranium at 20% purity, markedly distancing from the 3.67% cap set by the nuclear deal. The legal team here says the lawsuit against the U.S. pursues a single goal: to break the chain of its unlawful targeting of its key scientists. However, while the five slain scientists are viewed as the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry, officials say the sector is up and running. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives is expected to consider launching an impeachment process against the U.S. president on Wednesday. The Democratic lawmakers say they will move ahead with the measure if Vice President Mike Pence refuses to invoke the 25th Amendment, an article that would immediately unseat the president if he is deemed unfit for office.
That's going to be very difficult to achieve, one, because I don't think Vice President Pence is inclined to do so. Probably viewing it as political suicide for his future in case he wants to run for president in the future. So I don't think that one's likely. In the context of impeachment, it is a political process. And right now, I think the will is there by the Democratic Party. And it seems like even some Republicans may be interested.
So far, we've seen an unwillingness of Pence in particular to move forward with the 25th Amendment. And Trump, of course, is not taking responsibility or taking it upon himself to resign, as he has been called upon to do. So I'm not surprised that impeachment is likely to be the result.
Democrats and a few Republican lawmakers are calling for Trump's removal from office, citing his conduct and rhetoric. Experts say the lack of bipartisan balance in the calls, however, can put U.S. national security at risk.
I think there's certainly a risk of something atrocious happening. I hope, hearing that Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, had been in contact with Pentagon officials, there may be some checks, but it does reveal somewhat of a danger in our process in terms of how powerful the executive is, and maybe we should think about that in the future.
The longer he remains in office, he still has access to all kinds of classified information and security codes. He has been isolating himself, which elevates the level of uncertainty about his actions in the coming days and weeks. So, yeah, I think there's definitely reason to be concerned about our overall security.
Last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi underlined the urgency to remove Trump by speaking with Pentagon officials about safeguards of the president's access to the nuclear codes in the last days of his presidency. To make matters worse for Trump, the U.S. Department of Justice hasn't ruled out filing charges of insurrection, sedition, and attempted coup against him. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Carvello.
Coronavirus infections among the general population are still rising in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The number of infections has risen to over 45,000, mostly since August of last year. Hospitals in Gaza continue to run low on intensive care units and ventilators, as well as medicines and equipment. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on Gaza's health sector.
The international community must exert real pressure on Israel to end its illegal blockade of Gaza and allow local authorities to combat the coronavirus pandemic. The international community must also provide badly needed medical aid to the overwhelmed health sector in Gaza, which is already in a bad shape and struggling to fight the coronavirus.
The pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip, threatening the socio-economic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
People here are terrified by the rapid spread of coronavirus infections. Our hospital lack of vital equipment and medicines, and our health system has been battered by the Israel blockade.
The economy has been hit hard by the pandemic, and people are afraid and hardly have any income. Nowadays, it is very hard to maintain a business because of the tight restrictions.
Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the spread of COVID-19. They currently impose lockdowns from 8 p.m. until 7 a.m. and a complete curfew on Fridays and Saturdays.
The emergency measures, including lockdowns, will continue in order to fight the spread of the virus. We call on everyone to stay at home during the lockdowns and abide by safety measures.
Human rights groups have repeatedly warned of the catastrophic implications of coronavirus spread in the Gaza Strip.
Experts say Israel's inhumane practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to fight the pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Iranian experts and ophthalmologists have gathered in Tehran to unveil a new method in eye surgery which enables the doctors to cure problems in their offices without anesthesia and bleeding. Paniz Plexer offers an alternative to invasive surgical procedures, reducing recovery time and any complications that can arise before and after surgery. It is an innovative development in eye treatments by utilizing the fourth state of matter, or plasma.
This new technique that uses plasma is being practiced for the first time. Within the past 20 years, plasma has been used in dentistry, treatment of cancer, and scar healing. Since some years ago, we decided to use it in ophthalmology to make sure it is safe. Almost 15 eye diseases can be cured at the doctor's office without going to the surgery room.
This is an international event to unveil a low-cost method for eye disorder treatments. It is a pain-free Iranian method called PANIS, or plasma-assisted non-invasive surgery. This is a result of 5 years of collaboration between two Iranian companies and an Italian counterpart.
This method has been practiced in many countries, but Iranian scientists have now turned it to a method to decrease treatment costs, as it does not need surgery rooms and hospital beds.
Such outstanding achievements show that the sanctions by the West have not been able to slow down Iran's advancement, proving that the Islamic Republic is moving forward on the right track. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
In the limelight.
The U.S. has always been a violent and polarized society with huge internal social tensions, as exemplified by its turbulent history of slavery, civil war, genocide against Native Americans, and civil rights mobilizations in 1950s and 60s. Despite the U.S. fixation on external threats, the biggest attack on American democracy came from within, says Marco Cornelis, writer, in an article published under the heading, U.S. Capitol Riots. The biggest threat to America is at home. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. For at least three decades, the U.S. victory in the Cold War notwithstanding, American governments have overflowed with political statements and warnings highlighting how much the country and its democracy are under attack. Its freedom and interest, they argue, are threatened by Russian authoritarianism and cyber warfare, China's trade and technological war, state terrorism, and North Korean nuclear weapons. Even small and fragile states such as Serbia, Libya, and even Panama have been included in the extended U.S. definition of threat. On January 6th, however, it became far too evident that the biggest threat to U.S. democracy is internal, and it is represented by some of its own citizens. Images of the U.S. Capitol building being stormed by President Donald Trump's supporters on Wednesday, January 6th, offered a stark representation of this sad and embarrassing reality, which has not spared the U.S. from sarcastic comments highlighting its usual double standard. No Chinese wolf or cyber warrior or no Russian internet troll ever achieved
what we watched outside and inside the Capitol in Washington on Wednesday, January 6th. The U.S. Congress recently approved another huge defense bill, vastly overshadowing both the country's friends and its foes. To ensure unparalleled military and intelligence capabilities around the globe, and yet sadly, it appears incapable of protecting even the headquarters of its own democracy. The unpreparedness of U.S. law enforcement and intelligence on Wednesday, January 6th, was unbelievable. A full investigation is urgently needed. After Pearl Harbor and 9/11, the events of January 6th mark the third dramatic example in less than a century in which the United States has shown such incredible weakness and negligence. Far too alert to external threats, the country is inconceivably blind towards internal ones. It is time to come to terms with an inconvenient truth. The United States has always been looking for external enemies, monsters to destroy, to keep at bay its internal ones. Trump's presidency and his supporters, whether deliberately or not, have finally ripped through this evil of hypocrisy. The U.S., unfortunately, has always been a violent and polarized society with huge internal social tensions, as exemplified by its turbulent history of slavery, civil war, genocide against Native Americans, and civil rights mobilizations in 1950s and 60s. For decades, the many good things the U.S. has provided a humankind's progress have obscured such original sins. But now the king is naked. A second civil war seems to be looming. The globalization and financialization of the economy in recent decades has caused an explosion of huge inequalities, which have also affected the white middle class. When such disparities affected only the black population and other minorities, a hypocritical business as usual mindset prevailed. But when the interests of the white middle America was also severely touched, the system started collapsing. The financial bubble exploded into a new age, heavily affecting wide segments of the society, including the white population. The revolt of deplorables began to brew, first with Sarah Palin in 2008 presidential race and the rise of the Tea Party, and then with the slow, unsettling metamorphosis inside the Republican Party. Former President Barack Obama, who was not helped by his Hamletic doubts and irresoluteness, tried to manage and heal such fractures, but sometimes legitimate anger, joined by lunatic conspiracy views fueled by social media, prevailed and brought Trump to the White House. No matter how much effort Washington's blob, a term for the U.S. foreign policy and security establishment, put into distracting Americans with real or alleged external threats, the country's internal contradictions have prevailed. The COVID-19 pandemic and its dramatic economic and social consequences have further exemplified how broken the U.S. is and how unfairly it treats too many of its own citizens. Trump's presidency will be studied by legions of historians and scholars. The temptations to dismiss it as an aberration or temporary foolishness and to resume business as usual will be very high but this would be a huge and unforgivable error. The 25th President of the United States has revealed only the tip of a far larger and very concerning iceberg.